Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Dallin Oaks ascends to the presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and concedes we do not have the answers to all of the world's problems. Governor Cox taps an originalist for the open Utah Supreme Court spot amid tension between legislature and judiciary. And Utah book bans may not go far enough, a state audit finds, citing notable amounts of sexual content still in schools. Later in the program, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Right now, we bring in politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, happy to be here, Tom.
Thank you. And we also have with us education reporter Carmen Nesbitt. Carmen, thank you.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Hello. Good to have you with us. Let's start with Robert, we will definitely talk about the open Supreme Court seat, but Robert, you have yet another story on redistricting. This is the story that keeps on giving. Tell us the latest is what's happening here.
I think the latest is my brain's about to explode.
Right.
I'm a little bit overwhelmed with all of this, but... So essentially what has happened this week is the Utah Republican Party has filed for to run a ballot initiative, a ballot referendum, and what they call an indirect initiative, and we'll explain what those are. Basically, the aim is to try to repeal both the map that the legislature passed, the replacement map that they passed last week on October 6th, trying to repeal that and also repeal Prop 4 in total. The referendum would repeal the map. They have to go out and gather 141,000 signatures, roughly, plus some extras because they won't all count. But they have to have 140,000 valid signatures, and if they get that, it goes on the repeal goes on the 2026 ballot. But the key part of this is that once the signatures are verified or validated and it's certified for the ballot, that map C gets put on hold after the election. So that creates a question of, okay, well, what map are we going to use then when we have candidates filing to run for election next year? That's where the indirect initiative comes in. And so in Utah law, if you gather 70,000-ish signatures, valid signatures, you can compel the legislature to have an up or down vote on a specific proposal. And in this case, their proposal is to repeal Proposition 4, which had that ban on partisan gerrymandering that led to the court fight, that led to the maps being thrown out. They believe that if they repeal Prop 4, then the whole problem goes away in their eyes. The court obviously, this Utah Supreme Court last year obviously said, well, you can't repeal a proposition without violating the citizen's constitutional right to make laws via the initiative. The Republicans are betting, I guess, that the court will think that a indirect initiative, this legislative initiative, would trump another initiative. You can repeal an initiative with an initiative. That's where that stands. The plaintiffs have already sued to try to block that initiative because they say while the ballot initiative that created Prop 4 is a constitutional right in Utah's constitution, the legislative initiative is a legislative creation. It's only in statute, and you can't trump a constitutional right with a statutory construct. So that's where we are now. And today we're getting new filings back and forth, arguments on the on whether the map the legislature adopted is adequate and what they should do if it's not.
So if organizers get enough signatures for the referendum, would that be voted on next November?
Well, so it would go on the ballot next November, but it would kind of be immaterial at that point because we would already had to have an election for those congressional seats. And win or lose, there's got to be some sort of... I talked to the lieutenant governor, and I don't want to, overstate it, but she was kind of pulling her hair out what is the map going to be? She's already told the court, her attorneys have already told the court that they need a map in place no later than November 10th. So county clerks can start making preparations for the filing period, which is January 2nd. Both the legislative initiative that they're attempting and the referendum have deadlines that would put it well past November 10th. Signatures are due for one on November 15th, the other a few days later. But before they can start gathering signatures, they've got to have this series of public meetings. They've got to give 10 days notice of those public meetings, and then they can start gathering signatures 3 days after. Then once they're submitted, assuming they get all the signatures, once they're submitted, then the county clerks have 3 weeks to validate this. So that puts you into December, potentially. And on top of that, the public voters who signed the petitions have at least 45 and up to 90 days to remove their signatures from the petitions, which then creates this, this chaos, as she put it, chaos and confusion in an already chaotic process. Because, like I said, she says they have to have a map in place November 10th. This puts it well into January and potentially February even. If all of those windows, time windows have to run their course. So it's mayhem right now, and that's why I said at the beginning my brain's going to explode, I think.
Right. Yeah, this is the bottom line, legislature really, really doesn't like Prop 4. They're trying anything they can to get rid of that, and they don't like the ruling, judicial ruling. So it could happen, I guess, that you file for a district, you run for that district, but you don't know
You don't know
if
if
you're going to
that's
be
the
serving
district
that
you're going to be
district.
serving
Yeah.
100%. Because if Prop 4 is repealed, the Republican Party, Rob Axton, the Republican Party Chairman Rob Axton, argues that the map would go back to the map that we've got in place now, which is very different, obviously, than the map that the legislature adopted, the replacement map. And it's obviously very different than the map that the plaintiffs submitted. So it creates this real uncertainty, and then it also opens the door for litigation. I mean, the legislature's already said that they're going to sue. As we saw, the plaintiffs have sued, it's the League of Women Voters and Mormon Women for Ethical Government. They've already sued to try to block this indirect initiative. And according to the lieutenant governor, I mean, candidates could sue if they get the rug pulled out from under them. If they spend several million dollars, perhaps, running for a seat that then suddenly disappears on election day. So it's a real, everything is up in the air right now when it comes to redistricting.
So what are the deadlines for the referendum and for the indirect initiative for the
Yeah,
signatures?
so they have to have the signatures submitted by mid-November. And that creates another issue, right? They're submitting the signatures in mid-November, then the clerks have the 21 days, but that takes you through the holidays too. I mean, they're going to be working, Thanksgiving and into approaching Christmas at least, validating these signatures. It takes quite a while. So that's the deadline, and then it presumably would be certified in December or January, and like I said, potentially into February before we have this whole before this whole process that's in place in statute. These are statutory deadlines that have to be met, run their course.
You point out in your story, Robert, that woulda, coulda, shoulda, right? Opponents of these measures would not be facing the possibility of a referendum if what if two members had shown up and if two Republicans had voted yes.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting little twist in the whole thing. Senator Heidi Baldry and Senator Dan McKay both voted no on the legislative map because it was a protest vote. They thought the process was unconstitutional, that the courts had overstepped, and they cast no votes in protest. Two other senators, your senator, I believe, Senator Chris Wilson and Senator John Johnson, were both absent, although it sounds like Senator Johnson probably would have voted no as well. But that's still, had they got to that two-thirds, had they got 20 votes for this map, then it wouldn't have been eligible for a referendum. So that's just kind of an interesting irony at the end of all of this.
One more thing on this, Robert. The indirect initiative—I'd never heard of it. It sounds like it's pretty obscure. That's controversial, right? Opponents are saying that it's not in the Constitution.
Yeah, they're saying it's not in the Constitution. You can't use it to repeal a constitutional right or rescind a constitutional right. And so they're asking the court to disqualify the initiative push. We'll have to see how that plays out, right? The to I've never been able to find an example of this being used, and the lieutenant governor said she believes it's the first time it's ever been used in Utah history. So it is kind of uncharted waters in that regard.
Well, I'm sure you'll be keeping us up to date on all of this as we go forward. Let's turn to the Supreme Court, and this whole fight over redistricting is one sore point between the legislature and the judiciary, right? And that's kind of the backdrop for this story. We've got a justice on the Supreme Court, retiring, and so there's an opening. Tell us about who Governor Cox has nominated.
Correct. So John Pierce, Justice John Pierce, is stepping down from the court effective, I believe, December 1st. Governor Spencer Cox has picked John Nielsen to replace him. John is a former law partner. Former law partner with Justice Tom Lee, Mike Lee's brother. He says he's a textualist and an originalist. He is currently a judge on the Third District Court. And when he went through his confirmation proceeding, the senators liked him a lot because they believe he's the type of judge that they would like to see on the high court. He is a very dyed-in-the-wool conservative judge, and they believe he would be a much more conservative justice. And so I think that, you know, it was almost a no-brainer for Governor Cox to pick somebody like this, knowing that he's going to likely sail through the confirmation process with the Republican legislature. As you mentioned, they're still seething about not just the Supreme Court's ruling on the redistricting issue, but also, you know, they blocked the state's abortion law. They had, there's been a series of rulings that have gone against the legislature, and they think the court's been activist and overstepped their bounds. And that's why we've seen things like the legislature earlier this month stripping the justices' right to pick their own chief justice and giving that power to Governor Cox with a Senate confirmation. So that's the kind of dynamic that is in the background, I guess, in this whole, as this whole nomination process plays out.
By the way, I did have a question on the Chief Justice the legislature has passed. Governor Cox agreed to it. Now Governor Cox would appoint the Chief Justice. Governor Cox was concerned when the term was 4 years, but he okayed it for a term of 8 years. Will that kick in once the Chief Justice retires? Is that when that starts?
That would kick in when the current Chief Justice Matthew Durant's term is up, and he just started a new term. But if he were to retire, for example, then Governor Cox would be the one to pick the next Chief Justice. There's another interesting dynamic. Emily Anderson Stern did a story about Governor Cox was asked about whether he supported expanding the Supreme Court. There was a proposal last year to look at going from five justices up to seven or even nine, most likely seven, there's nothing in writing yet. And Governor Cox said that he thinks it's a really good idea worth looking at. Now, the opponents of this consider that court packing. Again, if they don't like the five justices who are currently there or the four that will be there after December, then if you add some more conservative justices like John Nielsen, then you can end up reshaping the court in a way that is more favorable to the Republican legislature. So that's we're looking to that to play out during the upcoming legislative session as well. It's another twist in the whole process.
One more thing here. You quote Senator Dan McKay in your story. Mm-hmm. He says the relationship between lawmakers and the court's not healthy. That's pretty obvious. And then he complained that two of the justices, Diana Hagan and Jill Pullman, quoting here, gave answers to questions about legal processes, separation of powers that McKay says are contrary to opinions they have written. Frustration here. And you see this on the national level as well, right? And President Trump is railing against his own appointees. You kind of have to read the tea leaves, right? And hope that the person that you approve is going to rule in your favor.
Well, it is kind of funny because, these five justices were all appointed by Republican governors, confirmed by Republican senators, But these are lifetime appointments, or as long as they decide that they want to stay on the court. And so once they're on the court, you have very little control over them outside of potential impeachment. And so, yeah, Senator McKay was frustrated that he thought that the answers that they were given did not reflect their how they've ruled on the bench, these two justices in particular that he said he was part of the confirmation process on. And he said they're better at being chameleons than they once were, and so that they're I think whatever judge or whatever nominee that Spencer Cox put forward for this vacancy was likely to get a lot more scrutiny than the past ones have, just because they feel like they've not necessarily received the full story, or have had the results did not match what in at least Senator McKay's case, he feels like he was told during the confirmation process.
By the way, on Behind the Headlines, we're talking with politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, we just have a couple minutes here. I'd love to give me your cliff notes, have you give me your cliff notes of this one. Utah's incorporation law is unconstitutional. A judge ruled, the votes for Summit County ballot measure won't count. You and I have talked about this one on the program before. Kind of complicated. Give me your kind of streamlined version of this.
In a nutshell, earlier this year, there was an attorney who had proposed creating a town, West Hills. It's up just outside of Camas on off of State Road 248. This land used to be part of the Garf Ranches, which was the sprawling cattle grazing pasture on these really, lovely rolling hills. Goes up and looks over into the town of Oakley. It was divided into 40-acre lots that people could build a home on, but the cattle still graze there. And they the so the proponents of this township don't like that they feel limited in what they're able to do on their land. They can't subdivide it beyond the 40 acres, for example. They're limited in what they can build on it and so forth. And so they want to incorporate because they think that would give them more flexibility in the process. But there was this quirk where, the way it works is you propose your original map. People who don't want to be in the town can exercise the right to exclude their property from the map. They submitted a second map in this instance after a number of people did exercise that exclusion right. They had a public hearing on it, and after that public hearing, you can no longer exclude your property. But then after the public hearing, they added additional parcels, and those people didn't want to be on it, but under the law, they were not allowed to exclude their property. And so they said that they were stuck in this township that they didn't want to be a part of. Judge Matthew Bates ruled this week that law is unconstitutional because if, Group A, if those original people get to exclude their property, then people all along the process are entitled under the Uniform Operation of Laws clause in the Utah Constitution the same right to exclude their property. And if they were arbitrarily denied that right, then the law is unconstitutional. So he struck down the law and said that the incorporation vote can't go forward. So those 47 people, by some estimates, it might be a few more than that now, but at one point it was estimated at 47 people who would be voting in the November election on this incorporation issue, it'll still show up on their ballots because ballots are, going out. But those votes won't be counted, and the thing won't go forward unless the developers who are proposing the township, they say they will likely appeal the ruling. So there's still potentially some, again, action in the courts, like we've been talking about all through the first segment of the show today.
Well, interesting story, these types of issues, statewide, nationwide, property rights and growth and lifestyle, right? So I'm sure you'll be covering this one as well.
They want to preserve that rural lifestyle, and this incorporate these incorporation fights. West Hills, this ruling just applies to West Hills, but these incorporation fights are happening all across the state as we speak, and so it will send the legislature back to the drawing board to try to refine that law and make it one that would pass constitutional muster.
Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke has been with us. Thank you, Robert. We're going to take a break. When we come back from that, we're going to be talking with education reporter Carmen Nesbitt. And here is the headline: Utah book bans may not go far enough. A state audit finds, citing notable amounts of sexual content still in schools. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. More following this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune education reporter Carmen Nesbitt. Carmen, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Hello. Always a pleasure. Here's the headline: Utah book bans may not go far enough. State audit finds, citing notable amounts of sexual content still in schools. Carmen, tell us what the current law is, and then we'll get into the audit.
Yeah, that's great you asked that, because I was actually going to kind of step back a little bit, because I know we've talked about book bans before on the show, but I don't know if we've gotten into the nitty gritty of the law and like how books can get removed from schools. And I think that's really important context for understanding the potential implications of this audit. So basically in Utah, school books that contain school books that contain sexual content or nudity that are determined to have no serious value for minors are treated as pornography. Like, the law makes zero distinction between pornography and these books that have sexual content that have no serious value for minors. And so the law calls this objective sensitive material. And I kind of want to get into what that means. So objective sensitive material under the law, I'm reading from the law, includes descriptions of intercourse, masturbation, or touching of genitals. And nudity is defined as anything less than completely or opaquely covering human genitals, buttocks, female breasts, below a point immediately above the top of the areola. And nudity also includes any depiction of male genitals in a discernibly turgid state, even if fully covered. So in order to determine whether descriptions like that are considered objective sensitive material, what happens is somebody challenges a book in a school and a committee reviews this book and says, okay, yes, this is objective sensitive material. And if so, it has to be removed from the school district. It doesn't matter what school it was challenged at. All the book goes from every single school. And so then if at least three school districts or two districts in at least five charter schools reach the same conclusion about the same title, then that book can be removed from all schools statewide. So that is just kind of like the basis, right? So what state auditors did was they took a list of 22 titles, which were sourced from, this says directly in the audit, a site called ratedbooks.com. And ratedbooks.com is founded by Brooke Stevens, who is a member of the conservative parent rights group, Utah Parents United. And this group has kind of been very vocal about removing content that they find objectionable from schools. So they took this list of 22 books and reviewed the titles for objective sensitive material. And they basically concluded that 95% of the books had sexual content that would potentially violate Utah's law. And among those titles were The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, Wicked by Gregory Maguire, and A Clash of Kings by George R.R. Martin. And they concluded that because this sexual content exists still in high schools specifically, these books, I just want to point out, these books were not found in middle schools or elementary schools. that they recommended more robust material selection processes. So instead of kind of relying on a parent or a member of the community to challenge a book, and then that school's committee reviewing the book to determine if they find it objective, sensitive material, they recommended more policies for kind of that front end selection process where schools and librarians are vetting books. And so that kind of, we don't know what's going to happen as a result of this audit, but there is potential maybe for more legislation surrounding book selection process. And yeah, like I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but that's kind of the implications of this audit.
So just to emphasize a couple points there, the audit seems to be suggesting, as you said, a more proactive approach, not relying on complaints to trigger a review, but when libraries do intake, that the review would happen at that point?
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, that was the recommendation, essentially, stronger policies. And we don't know how lawmakers are going to respond to this audit, but that was the recommendation.
The auditors appear to have gone beyond what's in the law. They examined books for language and violence as well. That's not currently in the review process, right?
No, so that's not considered part of the criteria for sensitive material. But they did in those books found more than 800 instances of F words and C words, and 112 occurrences of domestic and or war fighting related violence. And the report kind of says they looked for that out of legislative concern.
Are the auditors suggesting that that goes in the law, that the review is additive for language and violence?
No, they made no suggestions about that, just kind of included that in the study, I guess.
Yeah. So we'll see what the legislature does. Of course, January is when the session is. So you point out in your story, Carmen, that the audit comes on the heels of Banned Books Week. There's a sensitive issue with public libraries. I guess we should point out this process, the removal of these books, is from school libraries, right? This does not affect the public, your local public library.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think what some of these groups are you know, pointing out, and I'll take the Bluest Eye, for instance. This book is written by one of the first Black women, or the first Black woman to receive a Nobel Prize in Literature. And yeah, the book definitely contains some, I guess, explicit content and some violent and uncomfortable topics. What these organizations are saying is, if we base, our decisions right, just about the sexual content that is included in books, and we're doing this on a statewide basis under a statewide definition, that takes away even local control of determining, is the Bluest Eye, right, objective sensitive material.
All right, Carmen Esbitt, education reporter, has been telling us about this. We have a couple minutes here. I'd like to have you tell me, you wrote a story recently about the voucher program. You're keeping an eye on this. Tell me, first of all, very briefly, what this law says and where people can spend this money.
Yeah, so the program was ruled unconstitutional over the summer. And the state is repealing that decision with the Utah Supreme Court. So that is still going through the process. There's been no ruling on that yet. And so we're still trying to find out and learn if the Supreme Court will agree with the lower court's ruling that the program's unconstitutional. But until that happens, The program has been allowed to continue. However, this year looks a lot different than last year. Basically, it affords homeschool and private school students a scholarship to spend on private school tuition, homeschooling costs, and a variety of other things. Last year, every single student, regardless of whether they were homeschooled or went to private school, got an $8,000 scholarship. And the rules around what the money could be spent on were, let's just say, very broad. After kind of reviewing how that money was spent, lawmakers put a lot more guardrails in place this year, including different scholarship amounts. So this year, students attending private schools get $8,000. But then homeschoolers between the ages of 5 and 11 only get $4,000, and homeschoolers between the age of 12 and 18 get $6,000. Right now, according to data I got from Odyssey, who is the program manager, the state hired them to oversee the program, said about half of this year's recipients are homeschooled and the other half attend private school. About 40 million as of the end of September has already been spent. The program has about 100 million allocated to it this year. It was just kind of an initial snapshot of where the money is going, who's getting the scholarships, and what it is being spent on.
I'll just mention here that I guess the law, the most recent law capped at 20% of the scholarship amount can go to extracurricular and physical education expenses. As you pointed out, Carmen, that originally there's really no hard and fast guidelines. I guess you could spend it all on field trips and such.
Yep, and that's why lawmakers kind of put that guardrail in place to say, hey, you can't spend your entire scholarship on, I don't know, a rock climbing gym or extracurricular activities like horseback riding. They also banned a lot of other things that were allowed last year, including ski passes and lift tickets. Furniture is banned. Clothing is banned. Food is now not something you can purchase. And general office supplies that are, quote, not specific to an educational activity, which we did see a lot of purchases last year. Megan Banta and I did a big investigative article on how the money was spent. And there were quite a few purchases, I would say, that were office related, but kind of raised questions about whether or not they had an actual, educational purpose.
Well, and we'll see when this has been appealed to the Utah Supreme Court, right? So we'll see when that ruling comes on this. Carmen Nesbitt, education reporter, has been with me. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Time for underplayed stories of the week. We'll turn to Robert Gerke. What's your underplayed story of the week, Robert?
Well, I'm glad Carmen's here because I was going to plug her Salt Lake City School District story. This is about the controversial firing of a West High principal a couple years ago. And he spoke to the legislative committee last month and said it was retaliatory. On Wednesday, I believe, Carmen, the superintendent responded saying that the allegations are ludicrous and nobody was retaliated against. The legislature is taking a really keen interest in this, and I don't think we've heard the last of it yet. This principal was loved by many of the students and parents and kind of was shown the door fairly quietly, and now we're kind of finding out a little bit more about it, and Carmen's doing a nice job reporting on that. You can find it at sltrib.com.
sltrib.com, yeah. Interesting story. Carmen, what's your underplayed story?
Yeah, thanks, Kirky. Appreciate that. So I don't know if you're a little bit like me and you're a little news fatigued. Yes, we do get news fatigued as journalists. My colleague Brock Marchant did a story about another Trader Joe's coming to Harriman, and it's just everybody likes a good Trader Joe's. So
yeah, a lot of fans. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're just looking for a light, fun read about Trader Joe's.
Okay. All right. Find that at sltrib.com. All the stories we've been talking about at sltrib.com as well. Following break, we're going to go to a recorded interview with Tamara Kemsley. We have been have had on the program today politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks so much for joining us. Thank you. And Carmen Nesbitt has been with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Following a break, here's the headline. Dallin Oaks ascends to the presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and concedes we do not have all the answers to all the world's problems. We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I hope you'll stay with us following the break. On this part of the program, Behind the Headlines, we are going to be talking with Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Tamara, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, good to be here.
So here's the headline. Dallin Oaks ascends to the presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and concedes we do not have the answers to all of the world's problems. Of course, the Dallin Oaks being the president of the church, not a huge surprise. That if it hadn't been, that would have been a huge break with precedent, I guess.
Yep, going back to all the way to Brigham Young, this is how it's happened. It's the most senior apostle after the prophet of the church is the one who ascends to the next top spot once that man passes. So we knew that this would be the case, with the caveat that, you know, the church does claim to be an ongoing restoration, open to continuing revelation. So that always means that there is the chance for evolution in certain practices, beliefs, and teachings. But no, it was very much status quo. The only surprise, I would say, was that rather than going with the most senior the biggest surprise would be in the elevation of Apostle D. Todd Christofferson to the first presidency. And the first presidency is the governing first body. It is the most, holds the most authority. The 12 do council all together, but it is the first presidency that are sort of that the counselors to the prophet are considered those two right-hand men. And Christofferson is a relative young buck at the very, at 80 years old. he's considered a fresh face and is pretty far down the line in terms of seniority. So he jumped over a few of his peers to be elevated to that position. Henry Eyring, in contrast, also in his 90s, like Dallin H. Oaks, he was in the first presidency as it was previously constituted under President Nelson, who passed away.
So give me just a bit of a thumbnail. Dallin Oaks, lawyer, Utah Supreme Court, former president of BYU. I guess there's some of the highlights.
Yeah, his happiest days, or the job that he really enjoyed the most before at least his entering the apostleship, was being a judge. He had served as he had worked as a professor at the University of Chicago, where he went to law school. He was the president of BYU from 1971 to 1980. But in reading the biography written by Richard Turley that relies heavily on his personal journals, it's clear that Oaks just reveled in the life of a jurist, and that he loved the argument and the presentation of facts and just the putting his legal mind to work to solve problems and come up with different arguments. Loved that life. So he was considered at one point a potential nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court, but was not ever nominated. Perhaps he would have been if he hadn't been made an apostle, because an apostle, you cannot hold any other position any other. It is a full-time job. But previously to becoming an apostle, he did make it onto the Utah Supreme Court.
So what did brief remarks, I guess, at that that brief, you know, meeting or broadcast, what did Dallin Oaks say upon becoming president of the church?
Exactly what you would expect. He talked about, you know, the humility, the responsibility that had been put upon his shoulders, how grateful he was to President Irene and President Christofferson. And it's a bit confusing, but anyone who is in that first presidency gets the title president. So even though Dallin H. Oaks is the president, they're all referred to now as president. So anyways, he said he was grateful to Irene and Christofferson for accepting their responsibilities, for his all the other 12 apostles, for their support, and that he is committed to serve the Lord. He did say that, you know, one of the phrases that we obviously pulled, as you quoted at the top of the story, is that he did say, you know, we don't have answers to all the world's problems. He says they've not yet been revealed. But he says what we do know is that we are all children of heavenly parents. And that was interesting to use the term parents, a reference to the LDS belief in a heavenly mother or mothers, as he has recently noted in a separate address. So he talked about the heavenly parents and that we're all called to serve children, the children of God. So that what is also notable, I think, and worth pointing out, is this was not a news conference. They did not invite the press to ask any questions. They didn't answer any questions. It was simply a live streamed event held in front of an audience of church employees and Irene Keene officials. And that breaks with precedent and is perhaps one of the more the things to watch. What does that portend?
What you talked with several people, maybe we can get some of these themes in here. This is speculation, we don't know for sure, but what are some themes or emphases that we think or people think that President Oaks might be putting forward?
Yep, spoke to different Mormon studies scholars, Benjamin Park, Taylor Petrie, Janon Graham-Russell, Brittany Romanello, and then, of course, Jana Reese, who is a Religion News Service columnist and sociologist. One of the themes that came up over and over, the most frequent in the course of my conversations with these individuals who are longtime watchers of the institution, as well as the rank and file, was that, yes, Dallin H. Oaks does have, he is a bit of a boogeyman for the progressive members of the church and ex-Mormons, that he is known to repeatedly come down very hard, very strict on the fact that only a man-woman marriage is ordained of God, and returning to that subject again and again and again, and really becoming the face and voice of the church's conservative stance on social issues, especially pertaining to gender and the family. However, what these observer types were saying was that they actually wonder if perhaps the group that Oaks is most on a collision course with are Latter-day Saints who support Trump and the MAGA movement. Oaks is a institutionalist in his core, in his heart. He's talked, for example, about how religious freedom, as important as it is, should not be absolute, that to live in a pluralist society, which we should aim to do, even religions under the First Amendment, with all the protections provided by the Constitution, must find ways to bend and accommodate other voices, other beliefs, and other parts of society. That in the past, he has also been very suspicious and wary of groups like the John Birch Society, back when he was president at BYU, opposing it there, and just has sought, very much sees himself, you know, people on the outside might disagree, but sees himself as a moderate.
It's interesting, you made note in the story that now President Christofferson, his brother Tom is openly gay, And I think you have a quote from Tom Christofferson.
Yeah, Tom has been someone who has written about his experiences openly gay man in the church. He has advocated for a more loving posture, not necessarily a policy change or a doctrinal change, but simply for there to be kind of rhetoric and more understanding and love shown to the LGBTQ community, both within and without the church. So this obviously is an interesting situation that puts Tom, that puts his brother Todd Christofferson in, to have someone who has, some have argued, been sort of the face of the more, some might argue, homophobic comments, to have Todd now serving at that individual's side in this very public capacity will be, I think, something that a lot of people will watch, how he threads that needle, if it's a subject that he comes to, if, however, the first presidency becomes more focused again on these other issues that are arising in the church, with the concerns about, you know, political violence has been something that Oakes has become increasingly concerned with. And indeed, Christofferson, who was one of the, was very involved in the prosecution of the Watergate case when he was just a fresh-faced, out of Duke graduate. He too is clearly an institutionalist, someone who believes very strongly in the rule of law. I wonder if they don't make that the emphasis and de-emphasize some of the other subjects that they've been, that Oakes has emphasized in the past. However, that said, it's very possible that they walk and chew gum at the same time, and there are multiple focuses of this presidency.
There's some speculation, given President Oakes' emphasis on the family, man and woman, right, the traditional family, that the a proclamation that was given some 30 years ago, proclamation on the family, might now be canonized, put into scripture.
That's right. Yep, we'll see. It is a controversial document among those who are identify as more nuanced or progressive members. It is used language about how gender is eternal, that men preside in the home, that women are the primary nurturers. And so it has both a very strong support among members who see themselves as more conservative, less so among those who don't. And it has been a divisive document, one that has been used in certain cases as a litmus test for what kind of Latter-day Saint a person is, and that it should it be canonized. Many believe that it would occur under an Oakes presidency because of Oakes's focus on the issues that the document raises, and because it is one that it's a point that Oakes has come to even recently in his general conference sermons, talking about how there is this need to understand and treat the principles found in the document as doctrine. So it seems that he has laid that groundwork for himself.
There's another prominent position still open, a new apostle. Do we have an indication at all when that might be filled?
We don't. Yep. Your listeners, your diehard fans will perhaps recall for our earlier conversation on this that an apostle is a for life position and is very much going to be a bellwether as to the kind of presidency and emphasis that the Oakes administration, as you would, will have. For instance, I believe two out of the three of the apostles that Nelson chose were international, and then he also appointed the first Asian American apostle. And sure enough, the Nelson presidency was one that was very global in its focus. So that's something to watch.
All right. We've been talking with Tamara Kemsley, a Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter, talking about the installation, ascension to the presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints by Dallin H. Oakes. Tamara, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
You have been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you will be with me again next time.